Welcome to the Fair Parenting Podcast, where we cover people's stories, ideas, and the progress towards fair parenting.
Welcome to the podcast. Our guest today is Jodie Gibson, a human behavior expert and master coach. Jodie is based in Michigan. Her work is deeply layered in developmental psychology, NLP, neuroscience, consciousness, trauma, levels of energy and intention. The intersection she created between these is fascinating. Being a Detroit native, her approach is always practical and conversational. Jodie coaches and speaks worldwide. Welcome to the podcast, Jodie.
Thank you, Fran.
Good to speak to you. One of the areas I want the podcast to cover over the next few months is how to cope with trauma. Abused and alienated parents experience trauma. We strive for legal and societal change where abuse and alienation are eradicated, but we also need people to be able to cope with the failings of the current system. Can you tell us a bit about your work with trauma, please?
Yes, absolutely. I think that it poses a great question to say, how do we treat trauma and how do we get in front of it so that people can start to heal? But I think we have to go one layer underneath that. I think we have to first understand what trauma is. And I think it's one of the most misunderstood phenomenons of this current time. In my opinion, I really think that trauma is anything that takes you outside of coherence. And coherence meaning my normal default space where my nervous system is in a resting space.
Yes.
And so I think that trauma is anything that throws us into fight or flight. And I think oftentimes people think that trauma has to be some big, huge, gigantic thing without realizing there can be these little tiny micro traumas all over your day. And it's dependent upon, I always have this reference about a map, right?
Mm-hmm.
How these traumas land on your map and how much space they take up is wildly dependent upon your coping system. But your coping system and your resilience is built around that same exact thing. Inside how much trauma you're used to processing and or how much access you have to your resting space. I share that in saying a lot of us have built our life in the fight or flight pattern, and we've normalized fight or flight. We've normalized dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
We've normalized trauma. And what we don't realize is when we normalize those things, it puts other things outside of reach for us. Like if I'm consistently in a fight or flight pattern, I'm consistently choosing things from a survival mode versus choosing them from a desired mode. So I'm not choosing things that light up my soul and set my heart on fire and feed me with happiness. I'm choosing things that keep me out of danger. I choose things based on what keeps me alive, even if I'm no longer in harm's way. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally. It sounds like the definition of trauma there is anything that can knock you off balance from where you would otherwise be, and that many more of us are experiencing trauma and living in trauma without actually realizing it. In fact, it sounds like what many of us have maybe been conditioned to or grown up with in terms of, you know, how we're told to live or how our environment is. We've normalized that, and in fact, it actually is trauma. Is that correct?
Correct. And I think it's this layered approach. Like, if I grew up in a family system where my voice wasn't heard or I wasn't allowed to use my voice, I've normalized that. And so now in my adult life, where else am I not using my voice?
Yes.
And if I'm not using my voice, what outcome does that create? And or what situations does that put me in and or alienate me from,
mm-hmm.
from not using my voice?
Yes.
It's almost like, I almost wanted to say, it's almost like a secondary gain, right?
Yeah.
Like I was talking earlier to somebody about when we're as coaches and we find these doors for people, like we lead them to the door, right? And they open it and behind this door is all this opportunity.
Yeah.
And behind the door is another door and another door and another door. But we don't even realize that first door is there because we've just normalized this room that we're allegedly stuck in. And it's like, once you open that first door, then you're like, wait a second, there's so many more doors to open, but you have to take that first step. And so I think that's what normalizing trauma looks like.
Yeah.
I've alluded to this, or I've normalized this concept that I'm stuck in this space.
Yeah.
And because I'm stuck in the space, I don't even have awareness around all the other doors or the options.
Yes. And you mentioned that people in trauma were making life choices based on fight or flight. I've found that, you know, I've been in trauma, for nearly 4 years, at least 4 years. And I'm making choices based on fight or flight. It's very corrosive to your entire life, really, if you're living that way.
Absolutely. And we don't realize it because it just becomes who we are.
Yeah.
Oftentimes I'll have people say to me, well, that's just who I am. And I always say, yes, of course that's who you are. But is that who you're trying to be?
Mm.
Or is that just who you've become over time?
Yeah. And you use the word map. And I guess if you've been living in trauma for years, that map is your is where you live. It's not probably where you want to be or where you want to get to. But if that's your environment, how do you actually change and get out of trauma, or at least cope with the trauma, but not live in fight or flight? I guess there's some of us that cannot avoid traumatic situations, but I guess the question would be, how do we live the rest of our lives without letting trauma affect our life choices?
Yeah, and I think that you hit the nail on the head when you said all of us live inside trauma. Absolutely. Trauma's all around us. The question becomes, how do we process it?
Yeah.
So when it comes our way, does it completely knock us off of our center because we were already in a fight or flight pattern when it arrived?
Yeah.
Or have we found a way to reset and find the resting place of our nervous system so that when trauma comes, we might have to bob and weave, right? We might have to, like, it might tip us over, but we stand right back up.
Yes.
And so I think that's the definition of, like, resilience too, and understanding, am I learning resilience or am I standing in a victim position that I'm going to view everything around me as challenging because I'm still in a fight or flight?
Yeah. It was interesting you said about resting point. Is that something that we need to learn, or we just get there and say, this is my definition of a resting point? How do we know when we're in that state?
I think that's a great question. And I think one of the things is, I think in this society that we live in right now, the only times we really allow ourselves to rest is when we're sleeping.
Yes.
But it's like, how many, right? Or like, even when we're driving,
yeah,
we're not resting. We're on our phone. We're looking out the window. We're like, I was gonna say, we're listening to music, but for some people, myself included, music is therapeutic, right? But it's like, I'll see people on Zoom calls, they're putting makeup on, they're holding their coffee, they're smoking cigarettes. Like, all these things are happening all at the same time while they're driving a car, right?
Yeah.
And so if we think about, like, when do we actually rest? And when do we get to, like, recenter and say, okay, let me set my phone down. Let me turn the music off just for 1 second. Or maybe it's on and it's on really quiet. Or maybe you're somebody that has it on really loud, but you're literally just going inside, right? We're going inside of ourselves. We might close our eyes a little bit and just sit back in a chair and just self-reflect and say, like, am I okay today? Am I okay right now?
Yeah.
And we don't do that. We just rush from the next thing to the next thing to the next thing. And then we crash and burn at the end, or we feed our bodies with fuel that's not good for us.
Mm.
And then maybe we don't sleep well. And then we wake up the next day and start all over again.
Yeah.
And it's like, for what? Like, what are we really doing it all for? And I think the more conscious we become around our actions and the more conscious we become around our being, right? Like, if I decide to say, no, my body is important to me, I'm going to take care of it because it's the only vehicle I have to carry me through this life.
Yes.
How much more of my life will I get to experience if my vehicle is in tip-top shape and I'm consistently feeding it fuel that it likes versus fuel that's just keeping it going?
Yes. It's interesting what the way you've languaged trauma with resting point and micro traumas and the way life is keeping us off balance. I've done a little bit of reading recently to do with food and inflammation and the effects that that can have on health. And it kind of seems similar in that the food you eat and also the way you process stress can cause inflammation, which then knocks you out of balance with your physiology, and that can then cause serious health complications.
Absolutely.
It sounds similar in that there's the concept of balance, and you can be knocked off of balance, and you can end up in a spiral where you're out of balance most of the time, and that can have severe repercussions.
Yeah, and I think that you hit on the head of something really cool when you're talking about like the fuel that we add into our bodies.
Yeah.
And so oftentimes I'm educating people and sharing with them two of the things that come up a lot for me are anxiety and depression in the world of processing trauma, right?
Yeah.
But what I keep reminding people is like anxiety and depression are both symptoms. They're not standalone things that just happen. They're symptoms that are connected to a root cause. Much the same when you were talking about food. It just brought me back to people pile foods into their, or liquids, right? Into their vehicle of their being.
Yeah.
So if I'm consuming fast food and I'm drinking coffee and pop and alcohol and smoking cigarettes and doing all these things, and then I develop some type of health issue, whether it's high blood pressure or insomnia or whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
So that comes as a, that's a symptom. And so that comes as a result to what we're putting in our body or what we're putting in our mind, right?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes people say, oh, I have, this is one of my crazy things I often talk about. Like people say, oh, I have insomnia or I have high blood pressure, so I have to take these pills, but they give me heartburn. So I have to take this other medication, but that medication gives me insomnia. So I have to take the sleeping pill, but the sleeping pill makes me feel a little bit anxious. So I have, and it's literally this trail of medication.
Yeah.
When that very first medication, the initial one, was treating a symptom. And so it's like, let's just figure out what's creating that symptom so that all these other things, like you'll be medication free. And same with anxiety. People say, well, I have to take my medication. And I'm like, yeah, I understand that. I think those medications are a temporary space that people can lean into while they're learning how to undo that pattern. Mm-hmm. So if I have a pattern of behavior that I'm not aware of that's created panic attacks, and now I'm medicating the panic attacks, what's my long-term outlook on that? And how do I instead say, let me figure out what's creating, like, what is it in me that's creating these panic attacks? And how do I repattern and relearn things so that I don't have to continue to take these medications?
Yes.
I think that's what people are missing.
Yes, I would agree. Certainly the use of medications is exploding in, certainly in the UK, but I know it is in America as well.
It's out of control here as well, yes.
Yeah. What are the side effects of or the symptoms of trauma? Because I've heard that you shouldn't live in extreme trauma for very long, but what can it actually do to you if you do end up that way?
That's a great question. I feel like the side effects of trauma are all these things that are, that people are trying to undo, and a few of them that I've named. So side effects of unprocessed trauma are anxiety, depression, PTSD, addictions,
yeah,
overworking, underworking, overfunctioning. Like there's a list that goes on and on.
Yes.
But it's the inability to connect with yourself.
Yeah.
And so if I can't connect with myself and I don't like that I can't connect, or I don't like when I do connect, and I start medicating that outcome, whether I'm medicating with, and I'm saying these are like the addictive things, right? Am I medicating with gambling or shopping or drinking or eating or just checking out in general, right? Like all of those things are symptoms of unprocessed trauma.
Yeah. I mean, I'm asking this next question based on my experience, but it will apply to a lot of parents as well going through family court. Can it cause, you know, I worry that it's going to cause irreparable damage to myself, the levels of stress that I'm experiencing over a long period of time. Is it irreparable damage, or can you get back to your center if things resolve?
Yeah, that's a great question. And does it cause irreparable damage? Yeah, most times it does. However, it creates a space where people have to become transparent. And I think that's the most powerful thing to understand about trauma is there's so many choices involved. Like I can't fix someone else's trauma, right?
Yeah.
They have to make the choice to say, hey, I have something going on inside of me that's creating these outcomes and I want something different. So I'm going to learn to either to use new tools, or I'm going to learn to do something different so that I have a better outcome or the outcome that I desire. And so I think one of the things often is you'll see like wildly dysfunctional families that really stay undercover, right? Like it's under wraps. Like you would never imagine that's what was happening in that household. And they just have this one kid, right? Where they're like, oh, well, that's the bad kid of the family, or that's the black sheep, or that's the one that doesn't listen.
Yeah.
Or that's the one that has a drug problem. It's like, whatever that is, that's not the one bad kid. That's the pinnacle point of the family of trauma.
Yes.
That kid didn't just arrive there by themselves. And so it's taking a look inside. I think sometimes people look at kids that are not only defiant, but like skipping school or not doing well in class, and not realizing that that kid is a product of their environment. There's nothing wrong with that child. There's something wrong with the support system that that child is coming from.
Yeah.
And the access to themselves that that kid has.
And I guess there are not enough resources put into fixing family trauma. I don't know how it is in America, but I don't think there are enough. For example, there was a story, we're recording this on the 30th of November, there was a story yesterday in the UK. They said, I forget the percentage now, but it was something like 40% of teenagers could potentially have a personality disorder. That was the news story of yesterday. But there's no way we have the resources in place to treat these children effectively. What can a family, whether you're trying to treat a child or a parent going through family court, what tools, how can people deal with this in the absence of, you know, a state-provided therapist? Are there books? I know you've written a book and audio. You know, what tools can people find for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. And I think it's a multifaceted question. So I think the first one is understanding if they're saying 40% of kids have, what did you say, multiple personalities?
Personality disorder.
Oh, personality disorder. That's what it was. Yeah, I think I would lean into and I would explore that statistic a little bit more and understand, does this 40% have this identified thing, or does this 40% come from a family system that is not apt or is a little bit inept to this kid's needs?
Yeah.
And I share that in saying, we're not teaching kids how to feel their feelings, how to use their voice, mm-hmm. how to effectively communicate. We're only teaching them what we know as a parent.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of the parents are out of touch with what they know.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, my parent didn't teach me, but now you're expecting your child to know this.
Yes.
I think that's the intergenerational trauma that keeps getting passed on.
Mm.
The second part of that question was trauma, at least here in the US, is not taught.
Mm.
Like developmental trauma still does not exist in our DSM.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma is not something that social workers, psychologists, therapists, psychotherapists, no one's being trained in trauma. And so the effects of trauma are also not being addressed properly because people don't even understand what trauma is, let alone being trained in it. And so I think what the courts are doing and what the systems are doing and therapists are doing is trying to mask that dysfunction and or trying to address that symptom, never getting to the root cause. So they're trying to address the defiant kid, or they're trying to address the kid who doesn't show up at school, right? The truancy.
Yeah.
They're trying to address the violent behavior or address the kids that are smoking or drinking or whatever they're doing without ever saying, wait a second, what's the root cause to all these things? Why are all these kids acting out, and what's missing from them, or what could further be developed in them that's not being addressed or acknowledged right now?
That's really fascinating what you said about the lack of knowledge that experts have in trauma. In my own case, the court, at the request of myself, appointed a psychologist to look at the case. And this was after they had found that I'd been abused for 3 years. And I thought that this would be helpful to go and see this psychologist. But they seem to have an astonishingly little grounded knowledge about the effects of the abuse, the effects the abuse might have had on me. They seem to have very little understanding that of the trauma that I had gone through. It's interesting to hear you say that that's actually probably quite common, and that perhaps we're placing, you know, the word expert is often overused, but it may be that we're looking at an expert and actually expecting too much of them and assuming that they know things that they don't.
I was just going to say that there's a wild assumption there that people have been trained in something.
Yeah.
And it's gross negligence on our part as a society that we're not only are we not recognizing developmental trauma. In the U.S., the biggest book that people are using, the biggest reference or resource tool people lean into is called the DSM.
Yes.
The Diagnostic Statistic Manual. So in that DSM, we're not even acknowledging developmental trauma. We're not acknowledging the root system to the majority of the things that are in the DSM.
Yes.
And we're labeling kids with, what do I want to call it? Like, almost like what you were talking about earlier, the 40% of kids had the personality
disorder,
however that was worded, disorder. Yeah. We're labeling kids with disorders instead of figuring out how they keep making it to those criteria.
Yeah. The DSM is, people are trying to get parental alienation added to the DSM. I know that's happening at the moment. At the moment, it's not there. And instead, a couple of things in the DSM are being used to cover parental alienation, but it's not there specifically. And it's probably similar to trauma, that adding those two things, trauma and parental alienation, would help understand and treat people who are affected by it.
Absolutely, because I think once people understand what trauma is, they can then start treating the root or unpacking and unearthing the root cause versus treating all of the symptoms that continually grow from it.
Yeah.
Because until we understand that there's a root system that all these symptoms emanate from, we're just going to keep treating symptoms. But it's like, how many different symptoms do you want to treat to the point that you're medicating them and they're incapacitating people before you kind of take a look at the system and say, wait a minute, where are all these things coming from?
Yes.
And how does everybody keep coming in with this same criteria? How does everybody keep coming in with the same challenges? Like, where are we as a society that this is now a normal thing?
Yeah. Well, I know it's almost like you need to take a step back. As you say, you're treating the symptoms, but not the cause. And I really hope that both trauma and parental alienation get added in the near future. It sounds like it would be an enormous step forward.
Yeah, which leads me into, I know that we were going to jam a little bit about NLP, but I think that is where Bandler was years ago, right? Nearly 50 years ago, when he uncovered and, I don't want to say created, but created essentially. But when he started to recognize, wait a second, every person that has this does that.
Yes.
Or every person that has, right? And so he started to really get granular about the people that he was studying, and he found patterns. For anybody that doesn't know, Dr. Richard Bandler created, he's a co-creator of NLP, but his initial education, what took him to that graduate studies, is that he's a mathematician. He still is, right? And so his ability to find patterns was powerful. And so instead of finding them in numbers, he found them in people. But that's what we're not looking for. And that's kind of what I was leaning into earlier about, like, as a society, it's like, how about we look at, like, why does this pattern keep repeating itself? And that's what Bandler was really onto when he was like, no, let's figure out, how does somebody continually create a panic attack every time they see a spider, yet the panic attack doesn't happen if they look at a kitten?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's like, wait, what different choices are they making at an unconscious level that's creating this outcome?
Yeah.
Instead of believing that they're completely independent, because if that panic attack wasn't signature to them, then how come I don't have them? How come I don't have a panic attack when I see a spider?
Yes.
And I think that's what differentiates. And that's, I'm a huge advocate of NLP. And I know that it oftentimes gets a bad rap.
Yes.
It gets a bad name. And just to create some clarity really quick, I don't know if you're fluent in this, but what happened is Dr. Richard Bandler and Dr. John Grinder created NLP in the late 70s, early 80s. And it came to a point when they created all this magical content, and then they decided not to work together anymore. Mm-hmm. And when they decided not to work together, they kind of fought it out in court, and neither one of them won. And so NLP was not protected. It's not regulated.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens, is there's all these people running around the planet that weren't properly trained in it and don't understand it.
Yes.
And are using it in the wrong way and weren't trained in how it functions. And so I think that's why it gets such a bad rap, and that's why people don't understand it. But it's actually a really powerful art if you study it properly with people that know how to teach it.
Richard Bandler, I studied with him, and one of the things he does is the phobias, where he works on a spider phobia, and he actually brings out the tarantulas.
Yeah.
He works on snake phobia. He had a snake he brought out. I mean, he had some normal-sized snakes that were, I don't know, a few feet long, but he brought out one that was maybe, I don't know, 30 foot long. It needed four people to carry it on stage, and it was very powerful to see. He worked with people who have vertigo and various other phobias, but to see them transformed within an hour or so, it was just very powerful. You know, if we can do the same with trauma, that's fantastic. But I do believe NLP is very helpful. It's one of the things that has helped me in my journey for sure. And I agree with you about the way that some people are teaching it. A lot of people are labeling themselves NLP experts when they're really not. And what you explained about the way it's unregulated is very interesting. I didn't know that. So, yeah, it's a very interesting subject. And anybody who's interested, you don't have to be going through trauma. If you're just interested in personal development and how the mind works and how you can even just get better at skills or hobbies that you like, I think NLP is a very good thing to look into.
Yeah, I was going to share too. I think people can use it for whatever they wish, but I think one of the coolest things that you learn, I remember when I went through my first NLP practitioner course and I came out of it like I had so much more access to me than I had ever had before. And so I love your point about even if people want to learn it just for their own personal development.
Yeah.
I think that's really powerful. I often say like the more we know about ourselves and the more access we have to ourselves, the more we can help our clients.
Yeah.
And like the more we know what's our triggers, what's our motivation, what are we afraid of, what does our map look like, and all those different things, we can then start to understand more about our clients because we understand more about us.
Yeah.
And I think NLP was one of the most powerful tools in learning all of that for me.
Yeah. And I know we're both fans of another one of NLP's most famous practitioners, Tony Robbins. Something he said is similar to the point you just made. He quotes Socrates, learning is remembering. In this example, just remembering who you are. You know, we're conditioned so much by life to almost forget who we are.
Yeah, it circles me back into, for people that don't know, like Dr. Richard Bandler and John Grinder trained Tony Robbins.
Yes.
And maybe I shouldn't say trained. Tony trained and learned and took some of the same courses that you and I took with Bandler, with Grinder. And so it's understanding when people, I think sometimes people think NLP is a dark psychology, yet they're fans of Tony Robbins. And I'm like, he's using all the same tools.
Yeah.
He's just really covert about it. And he doesn't talk about it openly.
Yes.
But it's all the same content. And I've had the joy of spending some really good time. I would say Tony Robbins was a household name in our family by the time I was probably 12.
Wow.
I know. My dad was one of the first people to see Tony Robbins at a conference. He literally went to a conference. He still talks about it today. At the Doubletree Hotel in Dearborn, Michigan, in I think this would have been like 1985, 1986. He thinks it was like $40. He said there are about 25 people there.
Wow.
Right. Imagine that now.
Yeah.
And so Tony was always a household name in our house.
Yeah.
It's like you never realize who you're teaching or who you're leading.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had an opportunity. I want to say it was back in 2018. To be a part of a small group that spent a day with Tony, and it was really powerful. It was really interesting to learn and to see and to hear and to be, like I have pictures of him, I clearly have pictures of him and I together, but I have a picture of him standing right in front of me, like talking to me, and I don't know why something told me to turn my camera on, and even to this day, it's one of the coolest pictures I have.
Yeah.
Because like, I think sometimes we look at people like they're larger than life. They're really just normal people.
Mm.
And they're telling things to us that we already know. And sometimes I look at that picture, like here's Tony standing over me, telling me and another person what to do. But the words that he was using weren't different than anything I had ever heard before.
Yes.
They were just coming from him, right? And so I share that in saying, like, for the listeners, like, how many books have you bought that you haven't read? How many podcasts do you listen to that you don't really listen to?
Yeah.
How many things do you know that you should or would or want to do, but just haven't yet? And I think it's just recognizing and identifying, what pattern do I keep running that keeps me outside of, like, all those parts of me or all those future parts of me or potential parts of me? However, there's lots of people that say, no, I still want to do this, or I still want to do that, or I'm not capable of this, or everything feels so far away from them.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. When they've normalized their map and their map keeps navigating them to the same spot that doesn't work, it's like, instead of medicating what doesn't work or being mad about what doesn't work, how about instead investigating the map and the tool that you're using that keeps taking you there?
Yeah. So that leads us on to your book. It's called Healing Your Map. So could you tell us a bit about how the map operates in terms of your book and how that helps us to heal trauma?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you for asking. Circling into the concept that I'm sure you've heard the term, the map is not the territory. It's a very well-known idea.
Yes.
And so staying inside that concept, I truly believe that at the moment that we are conceived, we are given a blank map. So you have a map, I have a map, the listeners have maps, our kids, our parents, our spouses, our neighbors, everybody on this planet has their very own map. And your map records every single detail of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It records every memory, every sight, every sound, every feeling, every person, every relationship, every fight. Literally everything that's ever happened to you was recorded on your map. And your map now serves as the lens through which you view the world. And you experience the world through this map. And if you can imagine, this map is literally now covering your eyes, right? So you walk around being guided by this map, and it keeps taking you to these default spaces. And you're using this map also as like a navigation tool, and it's leading you into the same space. Which is why you can wake up and go, you know what, I have this really good idea of something I'm going to do today, or I'm going to build a new habit, yet you end up in the old one.
Mm.
And so I always say, like, until you heal your map, you're going to keep going to the old spaces.
Yes.
And I think, too, people use this map and they think that everybody has the same view. They think that everybody's looking at the same thing, but they don't realize that their lens is blurred by their own life experience.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I always say, like, until we heal our map or until we recognize what's on it, we're going to keep re-experiencing all the things that don't serve us. We're going to keep attracting the same mate. We're going to keep using the same parenting rules. We're going to keep using the same habits, whether they're good or bad for us. And we're going to keep experiencing the same emotions until we realize what's creating all of that. And so the book was aimed at the concept of, like, healing the map so that you can heal your life.
And is that a macro level or both? Does it take you to a new map entirely and you build a new map, or does it help you kind of change the territory of where you're in? How does it actually, that process work?
Yeah, that's a great question. It actually helps you on both levels. So inside the book, there's 6 different tools that you can use to heal your map. And the tools are very high level or very micro, depending on how deep you want to get into your own world.
Yeah.
And so tools were created to create awareness, because I feel like, as a coach, I always say, like, awareness creates access.
Yes.
So if we want access to our map, we first have to be aware of what's on there. I share this in saying, I always use the fun analogy. Have you ever went on vacation or on holiday and you come back and you're like, your house smells different,
mm-hmm.
right? Or somebody comes over and they're like, oh my gosh, it smells so good in here. And you're like, what do you mean? What does it smell like? Like, you have no idea because you've normalized it.
Yes.
And so it's like, people are often like, what are you talking about? Like, they don't think anything is wrong because they've normalized their map.
Yes.
They've normalized their view. And so it isn't until you start to ask questions and work with a coach who really understands these things deeply that can ask you questions that you gain awareness where you're like, oh my gosh, I do that thing.
Yeah.
Or I totally have that habit. Or I do that thing because I'm always running the story, and the story that I keep telling myself is blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And it's not really about the outcome, that people try to change the outcome, but it's like, no, let's change the story. Like, let's interrupt that story you keep telling yourself and build a new story that then creates a new outcome. And so there's tons of tools like that inside the book that just help people get really granular if they want to. If they want to just read the book and become aware of like what the map is, they can do that.
Mm-hmm.
But if they want to dive all the way in and start to reprogram their brain and realign and edit their map and start to heal, all that's in there as well.
And by doing that, does that bring you back into the balance of not living in an environment of trauma, whether it's, you know, big traumas or little traumas? At the beginning of the conversation, we said a lot of people are living even with small trauma a lot of the time. Will this book actually, by healing the map, will that actually help them live more in balance and less in trauma?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a great question. And it circles back to what we were saying earlier about our resting place.
Yeah.
We can find this resting place where we're not in a fight or flight. And so reading the book really creates awareness around, it creates awareness for people around, am I constantly in that fight or flight pattern? And if I am, how do I identify it? And then how do I find my resting spot? How do I find that center of me that I can function from where I'm not triggered and I'm not constantly taken off guard and or emotionally charged by everyone and everything around me?
Yes. Because one of the other things NLP sought to do was speed up change, because obviously traditional therapies can take years to work. NLP was trying to compress that. So my question about the book is, everyone wants quick change. It's not always possible, but is this something that can bring about change in a reasonable time? Is it going to be something that people need to digest and it may take years to actually get their map redefined?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The book brings immediate change. Every single chapter has questions throughout the chapter and at the end.
Yeah.
That kind of evokes awareness for you around, okay, what was I making this mean? How old is this memory? Whose voice is really tangled up in this story I keep telling myself?
Yeah.
Midway through the book, you're like eyes wide open. And by the end of the book, it circles right back to really a healing space. I mean, I've had people say, I read the first chapter and had to set it down because I learned so much about me in one question or in one paragraph. And so the book brings immediate change if you're willing and open to be really that insightful with yourself.
Yeah. What sort of age is this aimed at for, you know, can it help, say, teenagers as well as parents?
I think it could. I think any teenager forward could probably pick it up. It's probably not kid friendly, but I can share with you, I have, my youngest is 12. She'll be 13 in a couple of days, and she could easily read it and understand it. I think the other part of it too is, like many other things, she might read it today and get some insight. She might read it 20 years from now and get a completely different insight.
Yeah.
My goal with the book was to keep it in layman's terms. There's lots of very interesting ideas in there, but I really like to make things practical for people.
Yeah.
I like to make things conversational. There's tons of analogies in the book. Every single lesson pretty much has an analogy or two or three that go with it, because I think the analogies and the metaphors allow people to learn at a deeper level.
Yeah.
It's full of those.
Yeah. We talked about NLP, Tony Robbins, and your book. And, you know, it's really amazing that in your own childhood, you had access to, you know, say the material of Tony Robbins you mentioned. I think that these kind of NLP and Tony Robbins and your book and similar books and content, it's wonderful and it's powerful, and it should be more widely available, not just to adults, but to teenagers too. You know, I wish I had access to these tools and information when I was a teenager. It would have made such a difference. And I really think that schools should be doing something here, because as we spoke about earlier on, we're over-medicating parents and adults and children. Perhaps what we should be doing is getting information like this to people, because it may mean they don't ever end up with the need for medication. And really, schools should be a place where things like this are taught.
Absolutely. And I think the more that we educate kids about their feelings,
yeah,
I think that's one of the things that we were not taught as kids was how to feel our feelings and how to use our voice.
Yeah.
And so I think when you teach a kid how to do both, right? And so I've taught both of my kids how to use their voice and how to be kind, where it's like, even sometimes you want to say something, and even if it might come out mean, to circle back and say, you know what, I was having a really bad day and I apologize.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and then to say, I'm having a really bad day, or I'm really struggling with this, or I need a minute, or can you help me process this? And so if we learn how to feel our feelings and how to use our voice, we then develop better habits as adults, which then emanates better behaviors. It emanates better beliefs.
Yes.
You know what I mean? You have a different reality now because you had these really powerful beliefs and really powerful behaviors that were healthy instead of masking things that weren't.
Yeah.
And so the things that we could teach our kids as parents is how to feel our feelings and how to use our voice.
Yeah.
In a respectful way for both. And I think too, as parents, sometimes we have to learn that ourselves before we can teach it and model it to our kids.
Yeah.
Because if we're saying one thing and doing another, it's not really powerful.
No. I mean, you mentioned these tools increase awareness, and that's such a powerful thing because we're not aware of a lot of things. We're in trance some of the time. Well, a lot of the time, I think that's true of all humans. And the subconscious is in control. Just jump off onto a similar point with societal change, for example, with the way the family court is, that's an awareness problem. People, and especially the people in power, don't seem to be aware of the trauma that it's causing in the country or in the world. And one of the ways that we can get change is to raise the awareness in the people in power and the wider community. So awareness, whether it's at a macro level like that or a personal level, is very important. And you talked also about communication and awareness, and you mentioned belief as well. Those three things, if you can increase the capacity in all three of those in a person, it's going to be incredibly powerful for changing their life, but also for them to be able to affect the people around them and their society. You know, you have to be able to communicate better. People are generally not very good at that at the moment, but you also need to be aware before you communicate and also have the right beliefs. So I think those three aspects you just mentioned, you know, are all tied together and are really, really powerful.
Absolutely. And thank you. I really, truly think that like both of those are fundamentally key to people. I shouldn't say to people, but to creating functional people.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep looking at our own kids and saying, these kids are going to run the world one day.
Yeah.
And if we don't figure out how to use our voice and how to feel our feelings and how to build deep, meaningful relationships, how are we expecting our kids to learn that?
Yeah.
Because even though we might be saying things, what we're modeling to them is completely different.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think it's understanding the role that we play in that space.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So where can people find out more about you or reach you if they want to be coached by you or find your book? Could you tell us a bit about how they can do that?
Yes, absolutely. They can find me at my website, which is jodiegibson.com. And Jodi Gibson is J-O-D-E-E Gibson, G-I-B-S-O-N. Also, they can find the book at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or pretty much any bookseller worldwide has the book. It's called Healing Your Map, A Guide to Understanding Discernment, Trauma, and Human Behavior. I also have my first and last name is my handle for every social media app as well, whether it's Instagram, Facebook, Clubhouse, LinkedIn. It's all just jodiegibson.com. Or sorry, it's all just Jodi Gibson.
That's interesting. You just mentioned Clubhouse. I listen to that occasionally. It's kind of hard to find great content. I think they should do a little bit more to help you find, but either that or I'm just not very good at it.
Yeah, I think it's these crazy algorithms. And if you don't stay on it a lot, it doesn't know where to place you. And so then when you go in the app, it throws you into all these crazy rooms.
I certainly end up in some of the crazy rooms. Yeah. Yeah. But it's an interesting place. And it'll be interesting to see how Clubhouse develops.
Absolutely.
Okay, so thanks very much. If you can send me the links and I'll put them in the show notes so that people can very quickly reach your content. And thanks very much for talking to us today. I've found it fascinating. And I hope the listeners, I'm sure the listeners will also. We've covered a lot of ground, but parents and children deal with trauma on a day-to-day, or can deal with trauma on a day-to-day basis. And we need to get better at recognizing when we're in trauma and also healing from it. I can certainly identify with living in trauma on a constant basis. And I think I've got some work to do there. So I'll be getting your book in the very near future, Jodie. It sounds like it's going to help me an awful lot. So I really look forward to reading that.
Thank you so much. And thank you also for inviting me on and allowing me to jam out and talk with you. I think this was a really cool conversation. So I appreciate you.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it greatly. So thanks very much, Jodie. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I learned a lot from Jodie and enjoyed our discussion. I hope you did too. I mentioned a story in the British media and I said that I didn't remember it clearly, but I thought there was something like 40% of teenagers could potentially have a personality disorder. I went back and checked because I wasn't sure, and the estimation in the story is that 25% are likely to have a mental health disorder. I'm not treating that story as fact, and I'm not sure I believe the figures, but the points I made about the story are valid, as we still need to improve resources and help for children. Okay, I hope you enjoyed our discussion. I really enjoyed speaking with Jodie, and please let me know by email or Twitter if you have any feedback on it. Thanks very much. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Please join us next time.